Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
Does he secure the bag?
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
I'm Jimmy Mayaha.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
No, I'm happy with Scrabble. Mm-hmm. Good morning. You tune in to Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters. We are live. We're bringing you the latest news from a markets perspective, from companies, and anything else that we can find in between. Please join us on our stream. We're live on YouTube. We're live on TikTok as well. Shout out to our TikTok family as well. We absolutely love you guys. You guys are probably some of the best voices that we have. Hey, ooh, we love the comments that you guys put out there. This week, we are taking a look at the aftermath of Liberation Day. And we say aftermath as if it's done, but it really looks like it only is just getting started. Si and I, throughout this live stream, might just decide to crawl under the tables, as we've discussed, because at this point, that looks better than what the charts look like. But please join us, join the conversations, share your thoughts. We'd love to hear what you guys are experiencing, what you guys are seeing. Remember, we're going to put out the rest of our show later on in this week. But for this week, for now, we're taking a look at what's been moving the markets and where we go to from here. Whoa.
So you forgot the budget.
Which budget?
Yeah, I know.
It doesn't really matter, does it? Oh, there was a whole budget vote. There was a vote. Things were accepted. It didn't really matter.
No, it doesn't. So instead we have Liberation Day with we knew this was coming, right? So Trump campaigned on tariffs. He spoke about it, I think, in his first week. Was it? He was sworn in on the Monday. By the next Monday, he already had tariffs on Mexico and Canada.
Did he sign executive orders as he was sworn in?
Probably.
Like before he sat down, he had started signing executive orders.
And he rolled those back. And we knew it was coming, but we thought there were going to be two things. The market was kind of thinking like a 10% base, and then actually do the numbers and see, well, you know, South Africa effectively charges a 6.35% tariff on average on American goods.
Not 60.
So let's go and do a reciprocal. These weren't reciprocal. These were made up. And what they basically did was take the trade going one way versus the other way, find the percentage, and
divide by two.
And then divide by two, so we get 30 with claiming it's 60. We don't have 60% tariffs on anything American. And then tariff the penguins and everyone else, et cetera, et cetera.
What did the penguins do?
So the one theory is that they used it by subdomains, literally. So Gibraltar is a subdomain, has got an internet subdomain.
Mm-hmm.
So Gibraltar, which is part of the UK, got a different tariff to the UK, although it is the UK. And then there were those penguins and et cetera. What's freaked the market is, I think, two things. One is the severity of the tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
The second is just that, and we've said it before with the peace or NATO story in Europe, where there's a sense of you just can't trust Trump anymore, and therefore you can't trust America. And this has just taken that many steps further. Now, the idea is you build a factory in America. So Nike, who gets stuff from Vietnam and has a 45% tariff slapped on Vietnam, must now build a factory in America and employ American workers to do low-paid, low-skilled jobs that the Vietnamese do, which American workers don't want to do when there's 4.2% unemployment. Really, no one's interested in that. The bigger trick is it's going to take you a year or two to build your factory and cost you a whole lot of money, but Trump's gone in 3.5. But then who's after him? Who's next? In other words, there's no continuity. There's no certainty. And, you know, during the pandemic, the big word was unprecedented, and that got boring. It's that lack of certainty. So if you are a corporate bigwig, how do you plan for anything where you just don't know what's going to be happening today, never mind this year, never mind in 3 years' time when we get a new president, never mind who will be next and what will be next?
So for those out there that are listening to the audio, not exactly watching us in studio, or you kind of missed the start of our show, what we do as we come into studio is we've recently just started looking at, or we've actually just started deciding on what random songs make sense for us on a particular day, right? And I specifically chose a song today, and it just so happened that it lined up with Simon's song, and we didn't even know when we chose these songs, right? So Si's song was
the Nancy Sinatra, "These Boots Are Made for Walking."
Nancy Sinatra, "These Boots Are Made for Walking." Mine was Frank Sinatra, "My Way." And my theory is, is that we've effectively got two paths here. One we have explored. Orange Mussolini, completely out of his mind, doesn't know, doesn't care, is doing his own thing, right? The other side of it is presidencies. As a president, when you leave office, you aim to have a legacy that you are known for.
Yeah.
It was Obamacare. It was economic growth in the case of Thabo Mbeki. It was, you know, so as a president, there's a defining something that you leave office for. And I'm afraid to even conceptualize that Donald Trump's advisory team could have thought this far ahead in what they've done here. Remember we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago. We had an episode about this, I think it was maybe two or three episodes ago, where I said, could Trump be an evil genius? Right? We're in 2025. In 2026, there is an estimated $9 trillion of US treasuries that are set to roll over from an expiry point of view, which means you're going to refinance those. And if you are refinancing at an interest rate that is at the current levels, that means your cost of refinancing is excessively high. Yet, if you collapse the market just in time for enough rate cuts to come through, you're refinancing $9 trillion or more of US debt at an infinitely lower percentage, which in the long term is beneficial for the US, right? And also, in the grander scheme of things, when you are looking at the reset, we've spoken about this as well. You need a reset event. You had a reset event with the COVID pandemic. You had a reset event with the 2008 financial crisis. You've run hard from the pandemic. You need some form of reset for continuity purposes if you're going to push markets higher, right? Now, this is probably the best engineered reset, if it is that. And I said that whole thing to come back to the Sinatra point. And the Sinatra point was, if his advisory team said to him, this is your objective, this is what we need you to do, he could have sat there and he said, I'll do it. I'll be the villain. I'm happy with being known as the global villain because Trump doesn't care honestly about that, right? But my condition is I want to do it my way. So when the markets are crashing, I imagine Orange Mussolini sitting in the Oval Office playing the Frank Sinatra LP loud as anything, silently, because the plan worked.
Sure. I mean, he's got the 10-year down to 3.9 from, what, 4.5? I mean, that's not bad. I think maybe there were other ways to get the
of course there
down.
Were other ways to do it, but do you think that was part of his plan? No. He didn't care about that.
Agreed. And at the heart of it, he's talking around the imbalance in Chinese trade. And if you look at what China has done over, they came into the World Trade Organization about 30 years ago. They are classified in the emerging market, which is like weird when you're the second largest economy in the world. Be that as it may, China has, someone said it to me, and now I can't remember who said it to me, one of my guests, China eats margins for breakfast, corporate margins. Mm-hmm. And that's what China's been doing. Look at these EV vehicles as the most latest example.
Absolutely.
So there has been a chronic imbalance in trade. Again, okay, so you've got a problem with China. There are a couple of ways to solve it. A, go chat to your buddies in Canada and Europe and Mexico and get a trade block against China, and then go chat with China and say, hey guys, and maybe put some tariffs on China. Why the penguins?
The penguins did nothing. The penguins are innocent. Leave the penguins alone. So the China thing, right? Interesting that you bring that up. I think it comes back to the whole reason why, and we had this conversation as well on one of the shows. I'm trying to remember what we were talking about when we were looking at, I think it was someone being upset. Oh, it was about capitalism, right? So effectively, what we're saying here, Sai, is that China beat free market America at capitalism whilst still being socialist, because they ate into margins, they grew their economy, they reduced their unemployment, they effectively did it with the largest population at some point before India took over there. But they did everything that you hope an economy would do, right? People are employed. People, now we can agree to disagree around the communist policies of China and all of those sorts of things, or the socialist policies. That's not the topic of discussion here, right? So you want to be seen as the leading economy. Now, unfortunately, you've got an economy that's risen in, as you say, the last 30 years, to the extent that they are now challenging you and rival you in terms of what it is they're capable of doing. And so you feel threatened enough to throw the entire world into a collapse because you believe that's how things should be.
Yeah. Agreed. And the challenge is, you're not going to onshore manufacturing capacity back into America. America has, it's too rich an economy in terms of, you know, GDP per capita. They don't, unless, I mean, the flip side is at the same time, you open your borders to immigrants to do those jobs.
You can't. You've just told you, that was the first thing you said. You don't want immigrants in the country.
So you can't onshore. Hmm. So this whole thing is broken, unless it's to refinance that $9 trillion in debt, which, I mean, I suppose crash markets about $20 billion for $9 trillion. There's a worse trade out there somewhere.
So this is the thing. That is the genius play in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be honest. I don't know if he's capable of that. I mean, this is the same person.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply... I know that... I mean, people have been all over my timeline all weekend telling me this. I am not convinced by the idea. I mean, the reason why the tenure is now down as we record at 3.92, to be clear, it was at 4.817 back in Jan of, oh wow, just this year. I thought I was going to have to zoom out further. People are buying government bonds in the US because right now, with all of this chaos, what's the one thing you can be sure of? Well, you're going to buy 10 year and get 3.9%. Unfortunately, inflation might be more over those 10 years too. I mean, that's the other flip side of it. I mean,
but again, this is why I say that even though you got to say I did it my way, is it really the best way? As you said, there are so many other more efficient ways to do it. And I suppose from his perspective, he was saying, I will get it done, but I will do it my way. And whatever that looks like is anybody's guess, which is, I suppose, this is where the fear part comes in. Because if you can conceptualize 14 different scenarios on how to reset a market, how to fix a global economy that is inefficient in your eyes, which, again, is from the viewpoint or from the vantage point of America, not from the rest of the world. Nobody else in the world had complained about this until now, right? So that's put that aside. Now, if there are 14 different scenarios to reset that, and the scenario that is chosen is scenario number 75 that sits in president someone's head, that's what concerns the markets. Markets are like, well, what does that mean for anything else? You had these options.
Yeah.
You chose none of them.
Yeah.
Now where do we go?
Yeah. And then there's the other point. And it comes to my first point I made. So Trump has walked back most things. The US markets are still, as we're recording this, 5.5 hours from opening. The futures are down, last time I checked, 3-4% on US markets. And that's on top of what is already a, you know, drawdowns, NASDAQ off 21, S&P 16, Russell 2000, 25% drawdowns from the recent highs. are you messaging me Morse code by
help.
No. So here's the fun fact. Top 40 is only 8.9. But the really, really fun fact is actually over 1 year, top 40 is up 10%. Well, and pre-open this morning.
Yeah. I was going to say 10% pre-open last week.
But it becomes to trust because it's that's the big challenge now. So if he walks these back and he's, I mean, I've always said I want to play poker with Trump because man can fold like a cheap deck of cards. But if he walks this back, the market's still like, yeah.
The market's not going to bounce back. It's not going to. So again,
because what's his plan B, C, or plan 95 or 112?
So walking them back now doesn't solve the problem, right?
Yeah.
But what we have seen happen is you have wiped out, you've actually self-corrected for valuation. You and I had this conversation when we started the show, and our community remembers this quite clearly. There was a time very early in our episodes when we started the show, and I said, valuations, you said valuations are stretched. I said valuations are so high that you can't reset them without a meaningful event happening.
Mm.
And what that meaningful event looks like, nobody knows. I guess we've just found out.
We've just found out. And now I'm curious. I'm going to call up. Let's see what the valuations, I mean, are they now, are the valuations, I always struggle to actually get.
While you say that, I put out a chat in our live stream on our YouTube, and I asked the question, is he a genius or a maniac? And I've interesting comment here from Pandu, who joins us in the chat. He's a maverick. He's not necessarily a genius or a maniac. So then where does he sit? If he's not on either side of the spectrum, where does he sit? And I think that's what the market is concerned about. Markets, by and large, markets can do a lot of things, right? Yeah. They can self-correct, they can run themselves, they can be efficient, they can find inefficiencies and, you know, you deal with all those things. Your challenge here is, it's not that he's just speaking. If Donald Trump was just speaking, and actually, let's give credit where it's due, Si. The first time around, right? Trump version one, 2017, right? Was Trump all over X, all over Twitter, putting out statements, crashing markets, moving markets on tweets.
Yeah, yeah.
This time around, he realized that the market prices in his tweets as noise, because to a certain extent, that's what markets learn to do. They were just like, oh, when he tweets, it's fine. So he found an enforceable way to get his tweets across, and that's executive orders, because he didn't sign as many the first time around. This time around, he's like, well, I'm just going to do it as an executive order. Then they know I'm serious.
Yeah, to be honest, I hadn't heard of executive orders until his first term. And it turns out they all did it. So the NASDAQ at close, the S&P at close on Friday, the PE is 24. Still not that cheap. And the NASDAQ is 30 odd.
I was looking through how bad it's been. Last week was the worst week we've had since the pandemic.
Yeah.
Worst single week performance in any market, locally, internationally, or otherwise, since the pandemic. I wanted to see if potentially it could be the worst week since the 2008 crisis, but it doesn't look like it got that bad yet. But the point around that is we are now effectively wiping out things that...
So there's a difference to the financial crisis in 08. Okay, let's go all the way back to, let's start in the dot-com. The dot-com was valuation crazy. You know, you put a dot-com in your stock name and you went up literally two, threefold. And this isn't exaggeration. I remember this happening in the late 90s and early 2000s. But then we had the 08 financial crisis. And what we had there was humongous speed by regulators to do something. Mm-hmm. Then we had, and that was a financial crisis, and we got through it in about 2 years from top to bottom. The COVID pandemic, again, both market and health regulators moved at amazing speed. Operation Warp Speed remains one of the most amazing things ever to get that vaccine out so incredibly quickly. There were other reasons, but still make no mistake. And there was a move at huge speed to do something about it. This collapse, he went golfing.
I'm just chatting to the guys in our live stream and our live chat as well. The comments there are quite interesting. I actually don't even know what to do at this point. I'm looking at the markets, and you and I spoke about this before going on air, was to say, unfortunately, this is not the end. This may very well be just the beginning.
Yeah. Maverick, eh? We don't
so holding on doesn't even like describe what we're about to go through or what we need to go through.
So James makes the point that, remember, there was another theory here where he's going to use all of this income to pay off debt. Now, firstly, it's not enough income. But the other thing is that, I mean, it doesn't work because so they're going to make maybe $600 billion, but the debt is $32 trillion, so the numbers don't really add up anyway. Even if they did, the idea that you're going to now onshore, which means you don't get the tariff, which means that the income falls away, so you're still not paying down the debt.
It does line up, though. It lines up with one thing, and that has been the trademark tactic of the United States over the last 100 years. And that trademark tactic is, if we collapse all other economies, then our economy holds strong by virtue of the fact that the dollar is the leading trade currency and the fact that we are, we can withstand the pain. So
they were beforehand.
Right. So we can withstand the pain, and therefore whatever damage we do to the world, it'll take the world longer to recover than it'll take us to recover. Now, in any other year.
Except for the breach of confidence, but carry on.
Yeah, but in any other year, that would have worked. Coming out of the Great Depression, that probably worked. Going into the dot-com, going into the 2008 financial crisis, heck, I'd even say almost in the pandemic as well, right? Your challenge now is that you've got countries around the world that are saying, but why do you get to dictate that we must suffer? Why do you get to decide when the reset happens? Why do you get to call the shots? And now with the emergence of an economy like China that says, guys, there is an alternative. I think other countries are now waking up to that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not referring specifically to the BRICS bloc or anything of that kind, but again, back to the 2020 pandemic where a trade war ensued and China came out of it and in 2025 still achieved economic growth.
Of 5%.
Showing the world that there isn't an existential threat anymore. Whereas in the past, we'd been led to believe, and I think about previous generations, the boomers, the Gen Xers.
Yeah.
you'd been led to believe that if this doesn't happen from this particular economy, then everything is going sideways and nothing makes sense. And we must all just believe that this is the gospel truth. Unfortunately, now for that economy, you're starting to see a world where people are like, hang on, maybe there are alternatives.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia is like, no, we will control our oil price. We are OPEC. I'm looking at the oil price now and I saw it come below 70. I saw it at $65 a barrel towards the end of last week. I can assure you, we're not going to have another oil price crash to zero like we did in the pandemic. The OPEC bloc will not allow that thing to happen. It happened once. They will not let it happen again. And you're seeing smaller emergences of that come around. So China will say, no, we're going to make sure that trade happens, right?
So what is it that Ramaphosa said that applies here as well? Do not interrupt your enemy when they're doing the wrong thing.
There we go. There was some leaked audio. Yes. Do not interrupt your enemy. Yes. And perhaps that's exactly what the market might start to do as well. The market might then start to look at this and internalize it. And I'm two minds about it, right? So in the past, again, having not lived through as many of these events, but having lived through a significant amount of resets in one lifetime, you know, when they call these things are called black swan events, for those of you out there that are wondering. And it's typically referred to as a black swan events because you see white swans out on a lake, but you seldom see a black swan. It's a once in a lifetime kind of event. And if we're talking once in a lifetime kind of events, in my brief lifetime, there's been a dot-com crash. There's been a financial crisis in 2008. There's been a global pandemic. There is now this happening. Four times in one lifetime. I don't know if it's black swan anymore. And I think the market's also going to start to wake up and be like, you know what, we can survive these things.
So there's some good news here. When I tweeted at 9:12, the market was 5% down. And now at 10:12, it is 2.9% down.
So markets are correcting. Markets are finding liquidity. Markets are approaching this from a rational point of view and saying, even though there is irrationality involved in the markets, where is the rationality?
Yeah, Capitec 150 off the low.
Let us know where the rationality is, folks. We are out of time for Market Matters. We are going to get into our deep dive next. We're going to get into our investor insights. We'd love to hear your thoughts around the events unfolding. We'd love to get your take on how much longer we have to hold on for. We'll see where we go. I think at this point, it's unfortunate. I don't even know. That's Market Matters. We're going to leave it on that note. In our deep dive this week, we are diving into the permutations around a recession. We're going to call this one the Great Recession. The Great Depression was in the 30s. The 2008 financial crisis happened. This one, or we can call it Trump Session. I suppose that's fitting. If you're going to have something named after you, why not it be a Great Recession? There are so many different permutations around how we get to that recession, right? Now, there's a technical definition around a technical recession is two consecutive quarters of economic decline, not economic growth. And that is a technical recession, not a full-blown recession, because a full-blown recession, I believe, would be...
Well, no, it's a two consecutive negative quarters of GDP is a recession.
Well, we call it a technical recession in this country.
America has a National Bureau of Economic something or other who pronounce whether something really is or isn't. Mm. A depression, I suppose, is just when the recession goes on forever.
There we go. So a prolonged recession becomes a depression. But at what point does a decline constitute a recession in America, right?
Mm-hmm.
When there's a significant and widespread downturn in economic activity that lasts for more than a few months, typically two consecutive quarters of GDP growth is what a recession is defined as. Now, the interesting thing is there have been conversations that say or that suggest that we could be seeing a recession happen in America. And obviously a recession in America we've spoken about would potentially trigger a global recession.
And to be clear, we have had no growth in the last 15 years. So I mean,
that's our own problem, really.
I know. So we've been skirting with it already. I mean, in essence, it is. I mean, so we saw a massive recession in the pandemic, but that was like a flash recession almost. Mm-hmm. We saw one more intuitive, perhaps, was the 08, because that was a financial crisis, which this is. Whereas 2020 was a health crisis and 2000 was a valuation crisis. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at is growth disappears, just sort of, you know, goes negative. So people are losing jobs. Interest rates probably we would see them come down as central bankers try and protect people. Now, we've got high enough rates to give us that wiggle room. You know, if you'd had a recession in 2021 when rates were at zero, there's no space to cut in that regard. Inflation, because of a lack of demand, inflation could actually come down a fair bunch at the same time because there's no demand, because people are losing jobs, unemployment is going higher, businesses are making less money, stock markets are under the cosh, and everything just gets ugly. So, I mean, what do we need to do to prepare ourselves as individuals? If you think one is coming, if you've got an emergency fund, try make it bigger. Mm. If you haven't got an emergency fund, make one, because whatever, you know, you're at risk of job. I mean, I was at Standard Bank when they did the layoffs post the global financial crisis and the resulting recession. Get rid of debt, especially expensive debt. Try look for some side hustle extra incomes, just because you don't know what your income is going to be. There is, and again, when we speak about unemployment in this country, it's weird because unemployment is one in three.
It's I think at the moment it's approaching one in two.
If you use the expanded definition, we're closer to one in two. One in two.
And that's shocking for a country that has, 62 million people, of which 28 million plus are on social grants. And you need a workforce to get you through a recession, to get you through a depression. You need to be knuckling down and actually rebuilding your economy. Now, our economy on its own, as you said, has been strangling along, just barely making things around a growth, anything that we consider growth. And at some point, I remember we were talking about growth numbers being at 0.1%. And that's not growth. It's
the literal minimum
to not be stagnant.
Yeah.
So it's the bare minimum.
We need population. Our population growth is probably about 1.5%. We need economic growth of 1.5%. And we all go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
We need economic growth of above population growth for us all to actually get richer. Mm-hmm. And over the last 15 years, maybe occasionally we have clipped 1.5. Mostly we have not, which means we just get poorer as individuals on a GDP per capita.
Mm.
We've just been getting poorer and poorer as a country for the last 15 years. Now, that disproportionately hits, you know, low income houses, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera, or unemployed households and the like. But it pretty much, you know, there are exceptions, but most people get really hurt by it.
Something that we spoke about in Market Matters was you brought up what President Ramaphosa said about not disturbing your enemies. Something else that the president happened to say was on the back of the GNU. We didn't get to discuss this in Market Matters around the budget and the vote and everything that happened there. Now, what the president had said following the approval of the framework, the fiscal framework, which isn't necessarily an approval of the budget, it is of the framework that underpins the budget. We learned these things last week.
We're learning a lot this year. I would like to stop learning.
Or I'd at least like to get a degree for my efforts. Either way, right? Some form of recognition. What came out of those conversations was that at some point the DA said we're walking away from the GNU if this happens or if this doesn't happen or whatever. And then over the weekend, there was a lot of lobbying from big business to say, keep this government of national unity together because it is in the interests of our country to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a response or a comment from the president in his capacity as the leader of the ANC, or I suppose in that regard, saying that we'll take decisions, but we will not be pressured into, or we will not be, no, exact words, we will not be dictated to on what we should do going forward. And I found that as a very stark comment to make. Because how do you say we will not be dictated to going forward when at the exact same time you stand on a podium and you say the private sector must come to the party and help the public sector, we can't do it by ourselves, we need public-private partnerships. But then when the private sector says this is how we keep the economy from dying, you say we will not be dictated to.
Yeah.
How does that work?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it is, I mean, and there's something kind of dirty around big business pressuring governments the world over. But let's also be clear. This is how governments the world over run, right? Because they run their campaigns with donations from big business.
Mm-hmm.
Big business does have an outside influence in elections the world over. I mean, look at Elon Musk and his...
Prime example.
Yeah, his forays into the US, into Germany, the judgeship which he was trying to... Was it Milwaukee or Minnesota or
something?
Somewhere, I don't know, et cetera, et cetera. Those with money are forever going to be trying to influence those with power.
And it's so strange strange because at the same time, those that then run for political office then come out and say, no, we need the support here, here, and here. But once we're elected, you can't tell us what to do. We will then make the decision. So you want to use the capital to make whatever decisions you want, and you don't want the capital to ask you any questions around it.
Yeah.
So, have you ever walked into a bank and been given or applied for a loan and then want to tell the bank what interest rate to give you for that loan? Because that kind of sounds like what's happening here, right?
No.
Back to the recession conversation, right? We got sidetracked. We apologize.
Yeah. So it's things like increase your savings. If you can, increase your income. Be careful of taking on more debt. If you can, I mean, now let's be clear. Excuse me. All of these things I'm saying, lovely ideas. Not easy.
Not easy.
In the current 0.5% VAT increase.
Not in a normal cycle. In a normal economic cycle in South Africa, much less one that could potentially go into a recession quite easily.
So there are going to be, I mean, jobs become under risk. Growth disappears. We haven't had growth. We don't have jobs, but nonetheless. So it's kind of trying to protect your household budget, your household balance sheet. Take a scalpel to your budget. Where are things that you can cut, etc.? You know what? And maybe we don't get a recession. And maybe we do 3% GDP this year in South Africa, which is great. And you've prepared for this and you're like, yeah. Well, there's no downside. Now you could increase savings. Take a holiday to, I don't know, where can South Africans afford to go to Gqeberha or something?
Well, I was going to posture a different scenario a different use for the fund. So you've built up the emergency saving. The recession or the pullback isn't as bad as we think it to be, right? But you're still getting discounted values on certain stocks. Put that money back into the markets, which is effectively where all of the money is going to go back anyway, right? So institutional money is going to go back there. Retail money would go back there anyway. And if we are kind of heading into the next upward cycle, right? And you want to kind of move with that cycle, it might be a good time now to be stockpiling reserves. If you don't believe us, don't take our advice for it because the show doesn't provide financial advice. But take the advice of Warren Buffett. He's the only billionaire year to date who is still up for the year. Every other billionaire of the top 10 billionaires around the world are losing money year to date. Warren Buffett, who sits on nearly $400 billion of cash in the form of US treasuries, is up for the year.
Yeah, I am.
So he was prepared for this.
Mm.
Two people in the world, two people in history that have been prepared for this event and that were prepared for the 2008 financial crisis. Warren Buffett, Michael Burry.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, my friend Gary Boyson is going to chase me with this forever. I did a buy sell in Financial Mail in January. Buy gold, sell S&P. Man, making Michael Burry look like an amateur.
Here we go. No, you called it. But this is the thing. So from where we're standing now, in the event that we are going into a recession, you have to look at how you can recession-proof your life first, your little circle, your ecosystem, whatever that ecosystem looks like. If you're employing people, if you are a small business, a large-scale business, whatever that recession-proof looks like, this is the time for businesses to bring out, what is it called? It's called an RMCP. I'll tell you what it is in a second.
RMCP.
Yes, Risk Management and Compliance Program. It's kind of something that financial services businesses have to have in terms of policies and that. So in the event that there is a disaster, it's almost like a disaster recovery plan and all of that. This is the time to bring out those papers, right? Bring out that paperwork, insulate yourself, insulate your business, insulate your families wherever possible. And in the event that a recession does happen, you'd be better off. In the event that a recession does not happen, you're not worse off for doing it. You've learned some lessons. You've put in place some things that might even be able to help you if there is a recession in future.
100%. You've cut down expensive debt. You've built up an emergency fund. You've taken knives to your budget, et cetera, et cetera. None of these are, truthfully, this is what we should always be doing. Just maybe. Yeah. And truthfully, again, because we've had no growth for 15 years. So
how do we do that? How do we, from a South African perspective, because our scenario is unique compared to other countries where on the one hand, we're battling political, diplomatic, whatever international relations you want to call them. On the other hand, we have an economy that has been starved for growth for so long that I don't think it even knows what growth looks like. So for context, if an economy like South Africa that's been starved for growth for, call it 20 years, you've lost effectively an entire generation. Because when you had economic growth,
understand, 3% growth per year, your economy doubles in 15 years. More it is.
Right. Now, when you had economic growth and you had meaningful economic growth, call it around the 90s, right? Your Gen X's possibly even boomers, a lot of them were still in their prime.
Mm-hmm.
They are now getting ready to retire.
Mm-hmm.
Your mm-hmm. millennials and Gen Zs haven't had time to build
to up money.
Anything, any form of sustenance, any form of support for themselves. And the deterioration in the economy over that time has meant that whatever boomers and Gen Xs would have left in terms of inheritance has been eroded over that 15 years. So your millennial, your Gen Z are not inheriting anything. They haven't had time to build anything. Your next generations, your Gen Alphas and your Gen Betas that are here already now need to get into a cycle at some point, and you need someone to start that cycle off. So you had a cycle, you've destroyed it. You're basically now needing to restart that cycle over. And that's, I think that's what people aren't grasping around, the fact that it isn't just a numbers talk. An unemployment rate of nearly 50% isn't just a numbers talk. It means that there's certain things that become even harder to do. And from a South African point of view, that means that not only are you teetering on the line of recession,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to take much to tip you over.
Yeah, no. And it's spooky out there.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think I've just given myself the spooks thinking about it.
Well, here's something. Capitec's about to turn green.
Capitec's about to turn green after being down and opening down significantly lower for today. But I see there's a general sense of potential just rationality and stability returning to the market.
There is a world in which this market closes green today. Hey, we were 5% down. We're now less than 2% down.
There is a world in which the market closes green today. I've got a radio show later today. Si's got a show tomorrow morning. We'll let you know. We'll keep you updated as to whether or not the markets have closed in the green. But we're going to leave the deep dive on that note. And hopefully we've helped you prepare a little bit more in the event of a recession. And we wrap up this week's show with a look at investor insights. This week, we are taking a look at traveling with cash. And this is because of something very interesting that I read. Over the weekend, the Times Live put out an article that a certain gentleman was finally convicted and sentenced for something he did in 2017. 2017, he tried to get 3 million rand in cash and around 544,000 US dollars, so around 10 million rand in cash out of the country via airport. So went to the airport, booked a ticket to Dubai, and was caught with roughly 13 million rand in cash. Now, that's a lot of suitcases, eh?
It's a lot of because when Christo Visa, and he only had a couple hundred thousand pounds in cash in a suitcase, which, as he said, you know what, that was just like Tuesday.
I suppose that was a Tuesday for him. And we've spoken about this before. We've spoken about things like the limits on movements of cash. I think the current limit is 10,000 US dollars or equivalent thereof in terms of currency, in hard cash.
Okay.
So this was hard cash that whoever was trying to move out was trying to move out. So it didn't go as planned in 2017. And the sentencing happened obviously last week. And so I thought we'd look at that. I thought we'd take a look at if you are looking to travel, because we did the travel thing around digital currencies and how efficient it is to just tap and go everywhere. But you and I also spoke about the fact that there's always cash. Always keep some level of cash for emergencies, for whatever happens. You never really know where you find yourself. Is 13 million rand enough cash to keep on hand?
Yo, like, yes.
There we go.
Yes, sure. I mean, 13 million rand. I mean, you could buy a house.
Mm.
And a car. And then still have money left over for wings.
That's it. So many wings.
So many wings.
So many wings.
I was at a poker thing the other night and they ordered like 108 wings.
Mm.
Yeah. Turns out it's just 9 dozen and they got chowed.
I'm looking at the various countries and kind of the thresholds that they have, right?
Yeah.
So by and large, most of the countries kind of keep a 10,000 euro, $10,000 equivalent in terms of cash
that
you would be entering or leaving the region with. So the EU, Japan, Italy, China's on that list, right? One country stands out to me, and that is Indonesia.
Indonesia.
Indonesia, you can have, I think it's Indonesian rupees, I'm guessing, IDR.
Yeah, sure.
Approximately 1 billion, which equates to around 70,000 US dollars. So 7 times higher than every other region, that is logical.
But why are people,
what are you doing in Indonesia?
So when I travel, I You know, when you come back from a holiday somewhere, you've got some money left in your wallet or a strange currency, and I put it somewhere. And then if I remember, I take it in my pocket again. It's usually like that last time I think I came back with 30 euros. Mm. And then when I land, airport, first thing I do is I hit an ATM, which are getting harder and harder to find, and I draw some physical
because
euros.
Because other people are hitting the ATMs before you.
I go and draw some physical euros, and then I use my credit card the whole time. So, and last time I think I drew 200 euros, and then quickly at the airport coming home, I spent 170 because I hadn't used much. Mm. Actually, no, that's not true. I had used some of it because, like in France, like you go and get a baguette and it's a euro. But mostly I just use cards.
I did that as well. So I was, when I was in Dubai, I decided that, yeah, cards are all good and well and everything, but it's always nice to at least have a little bit of cash. So, and it wasn't much. I think it was also probably 100 or 200 dirhams or whatever it was. I don't even remember what it wasn't a lot, but it was to buy a bottle of water where I didn't want to have to go and tap for a 1 dirham or a 5 dirham bottle of water. You know what I mean? So for those sorts of little things, it makes sense to have that in place. Sure. The Indonesian currency is the rupiah. It was close to the rupee, but the Indonesian rupiah, which is the IDR. So that's from a currency perspective and at least from a funds perspective, if you're traveling, it is always beneficial to have a little bit of cash on hand. Also, having a little bit of cash on hand, right, means you incur one exchange rate. So if you're going to go tap and you haven't converted you haven't bought a foreign currency. So if you're in the UK and you haven't bought pounds, every time you tap is ripped. Yes. Yeah.
So what
and
I do,
there's no mercy from the banks.
No, you get totally absolutely ripped. So I get a card, Shift does it, in that currency.
Yes.
So I've got
absolutely
euros and dollars on my Shift app. I get there, I move some dollars into my dollar card, and now we see.
And you use the dollar card. Correct. Much easier, because then you don't get hit repeatedly with.
And then in Europe, they tell you this transaction is going to cost you so much.
Yes.
And my wife does the math and runs away screaming.
Like, never do that. So that's the other thing if you're traveling, folks. Never do the math. I did it for the first time on a school trip in many, many moons ago. I think in high school or so, right? And the school trip was another story. Accidentally ended up on a trip that had nothing to do with me, but was my first international experience ever, right? And I made the mistake of converting. I remember distinctly what it was. It was a £3.95 cheeseburger, McDonald's sized cheeseburger. And at the time, I think it worked out to between 60 and 80 rand. I'd never been so upset for a cheeseburger in my life. Still to this day, it haunts me.
No, I mean, I remember landing in Heathrow and there's a Starbucks and I'm excited because this is like 2000. I'd never seen a
Starbucks. Before Starbucks comes to South Africa, yeah.
So I go and I get a Starbucks and the lady behind the thing's like, "Yeah, my love, would you like a pastry or something?" I'm like, "Nope." And then she tells me the price. I forget what it was. I said, "I didn't want the pastry." She says, "You're not getting a pastry." And I'm
like, you're like, "That was just the coffee?"
That's just the coffee.
Yeah, so that's quite a bit. I mean, there's limitations where it relates to cash. And if you are going to be traveling, beware of those limitations, I suppose.
Yeah, and don't carry millions of rands of cash.
Or carry millions of rands of cash, but have a reason for it, I guess.
I mean, what are you doing with millions of rands of cash? I mean, this is the whole thing.
Moving
right?
It out of the couch? Sorry, too soon.
No, I mean,
I'm just asking for
because
a friend.
Yes, you move, because that's the whole thing with banks, central banks, governments. They want the cash in the system so they can track it. Mm. I mean, people say that Bitcoin is unable to be nonsense. You can track
the distributable ledger that has everything documented.
But cash is the ultimate. I give you $100 right now, if no one's looking. That's the ultimate. So
that's the thing. Around that, it's a very important point that you raise, because a lot of cash does exchange hands. And in the South African economy, we spoke about this. Mm. It's going to be virtually impossible to digitize the entire South African economy when there's so many informal traders, small businesses and everything that are dependent on cash.
Look, and they're trying this PayShap and stuff. But
yeah, but I also
point,
don't want to be paying. Yeah. I don't want to be paying for those transactional fees. Every time there is a transaction, an electronic transaction, there's a fee that's incurred. If I give you 100 rand, I don't pay a fee on that, and neither do you.
Yeah, look, you paid. Well, it depends where you got it from in terms of ATMs. But I agree with you, 100%. Yes.
And it depends on who got to the ATM before you did.
So I agree. I mean, I always carry some cash, as you say, because I want to be able to to, you know, I don't know, whatever. But these days I'm using a lot less of it, I notice. I'm drawing much less from the ATM. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like millions of rands.
Well, to be fair, if we think about it, 13 million rand, right, in US dollars wouldn't be that much. 500,000 US dollars in $100 bills wouldn't technically be that much. 3 million rand in 200 rand bills would also not be that much. You could probably fit, I'd say, close to about a million in a duffel bag, in a very small, medium-sized duffel bag or so, depending on who the duffel bag manufacturer is, in 200 rand notes, right?
15,000 notes.
15,000 notes of?
That's what 3 million of 200 rand notes is. It's 15,000 notes.
Yes, 15,000 notes. But how many notes make up a...
So I think a block
is... A block is 20,000 in some places.
I thought... Okay, when you get the little parley, it was 100. I don't know.
Okay, so let's say 100.
You could put 3 million cash into a duffel bag.
You could, because 100...
Where did you get 3 million cash?
We're not discussing that part now. We're just discussing the movement of the funds, right? Also, side note, disclaimer, for our audience, for our community, for those listening and for those watching, this is for educational purposes only. We are not suggesting or implying that you do any of this. We are scenario planning, and that is all that we are doing. Back to the number. 15,000 notes isn't that many notes. If we think about, 100,000 in 200 notes, probably going to be, 500 of them? Right, so a stack of 500 wouldn't be that big. So yeah. 5,000 of that is 10 stacks, right? So it's 3 stacks of that.
Yeah.
That's not that many.
No, it's not that many. I hear you.
There's so many places you could put that. Again, strictly for educational purposes only. If you want to inquire more, don't phone us. We're not the people. We don't know these things. We're just speculating here. Let's move on to our pick. What we're adding to our wall for this week.
So an hour ago, I would have said, I mean, I was really liking Capitec below.
I was at 2,500 rand. I was loving Capitec, and we already have that as blue chip.
Do we?
Yeah.
This thing's going to close green today. It's only 0.5% down. And then my other was Johnson & Johnson, because they're getting down to the 150 level. They might even get as low as 145. They got their talc powder cancer thing got kicked. So they've got that issue with talc powder that was causing cancer.
And they started using cornstarch and all of that as alternatives.
Yeah, it was cancerous. And so they put it, they try and declare bankruptcy in that company. And a chapter one, not even 11, just a chapter one, we will pay money. The judge said no.
Just make it go away.
So the judge said no, so it's collapsed a whole bunch more. The reason I like Johnson & Johnson is, A, it's incredibly boring, and then it gives me a really good dividend yield, which is going to be a little bit higher now that the stock is collapsing. That dividend yield's now 3.25% in dollars. Now, they every so often, they get into trouble for killing their customers. I mean, that is just the part of being a drug dealer, I guess. But that's just how it is. They just roll on past, and they have got cash. I mean, cash and cash equivalents, $24.5 billion. Their debt's only $37 billion.
An FDA approved drug dealer, might I just add.
Important distinction. FDA approved. Yes. I wonder how you get that FDA approved part.
I'm more concerned with the sustainability of their client base. They've obviously recently lost a significant couple of clients. We will not mention names. It's still very sensitive. It is what it is, right? We're liking the stock regardless.
I haven't we discussed this before because you've been done? Because I'm like, which client would...
It's fine. I'll let you ponder on that.
I got caught again. Okay.
I'll let you ponder on that. Let's just say baby oil sales are going to take a bit of a knock, perhaps for the foreseeable future. But nonetheless, we are liking Johnson & Johnson. We're going to put it on the wall. The question is, how good is it? How much do we like it? And where does it then sit on the wall? I think for the mere fact that the dividend yield is what you say it is, around the 3.25. That puts it above.
That's at Friday's close, and it's going to open today still lower.
So that easily puts it in easy money. Might even put it in like it. So easy money is kind of where we've got those easy dividends stocks that are going to be running effortlessly, making you some good returns and all of that. Is it worthy of blue chip status?
Yes.
Worthy of blue chip status.
I mean, you must look at their dividend chart. Their dividend just goes up all the time, every time, just like boring, boring, boring. They just sort of pay dividends always. Every quarter, they pay a dividend. Beginning of the year, they usually tell you what the dividend will be for all the quarters. They don't. You know, there's no stress around, we'll get back to you and stuff. I just think it's, where is, I don't have it. There we go. That dividend just trundles along all the time, every single time, going a little bit higher, never skipped. Not even during the pandemic, goes from bottom left to top right. I've only got data back to 1992, never skipped a dividend. And it's a beautiful chart. It gently curves. And in these times, I like these.
Okay, I'm actually looking to see so there are certain stocks and we have them as sort of your dividend kings, right? Something like a Coca-Cola that's paid dividends for 60 plus years. Yeah. I'm interested to see how many years consecutively that Johnson & Johnson has paid dividends. So I'm going to see if I can find that out.
Okay, I got to be able to spell Johnson first. How many years has Johnson & Johnson? I'm asking Claude.
Okay. Claude. Ask AI. There we go. Ask Claude.
Yeah.
I'm looking to see if I can find the information before Claude.
So I think Claude is traveling back in time. It's taking a very, very long time.
Dividend calendar. Righty-o, righty-o.
Checking 62 years.
62 years. There we go. It's a dividend king. It has paid dividend consecutively for 62 years.
Payout ratio 84% in the last dividend.
Cool. Blue chip it is. Makes sense. There we go. We've got our pick. That's what we're adding to our wall. That's going into blue chip status. And we haven't forgotten about our community. We are still going to reveal that announcement that we promised you. We've got something special that we are working on. Si and I are just working out some of the kinks around how we're going to do it. It's going to be a community exclusive. So it will be only available to members of our community. And we will let you know, hopefully in the next episode. So we've just wrapped up quarter one. Yeah. Hopefully going into quarter two, we should have this up and running and we'll see if we can get the announcement out to you as soon as possible. But folks, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you for tuning in as always. We leave you with an unfiltered opinion of the week. We never leave you without that. This week's unfiltered opinion of the week is, I miss the purist in the art form that used to be Formula One. And I say that because we're back in Formula One season and I haven't watched Formula One in years for several reasons. Mainly reasons around the FIA getting involved where they shouldn't be. Mainly around adjusting things and now a driver can be faster than another driver using DRS or be disqualified for something. The purist in me, when I grew up watching the sport, there was a V10 engine. There was a driver behind the wheel. May the best man win when those lights go off.
Agreed. But I remember watching Michael Schumacher win by...
Let's leave team orders alone.
No. Win by 70 seconds in a 90-second lap. I mean, the man was just... So what we do have with Formula One now is that even the car at the back is quite a chunky little car. And whereas back in the day, like Ferrari would work it out and just say at the start, cheers, and you wouldn't see Schumacher again until he overtook you or lapped you.
But that came down to the driver. Look at Lewis Hamilton. There was a race before we switched to the current engines. There was a couple of seasons ago, I think it was his fourth title, if I'm not mistaken, where he started 14th on the grid to finish first. Remarkable drive, something you'll never forget. Worked his way through, passed everybody. That was driving excellence. Yeah, yeah. He didn't have to wait for DRS to be switched on or to be enabled for him to pass someone. He didn't have to.
And in yesterday's race, all the DRS in the world didn't help.
See what I mean? So I miss the purest... The pure sense of what Formula One racing used to be before the meddling, before the involvement. That's our unfiltered opinion of the week. Let us know what sport has been ruined for you. For me, it's Formula One. Until next time, investing isn't hard. Just try it.